eating keto. But we about to change that today. Your clans with guns and badges, they won't be safe. Your pipes that poison lands, no, they won't be safe. It's time to fight with us or get backed away. Because revolution steady right on the itinerary. I'm sick of seeing all my people in obituaries. Stay mad, Karen, we don't give an F-bomb. Blow it up by any means necessary. Captain said that I could be a revolutionary. I believe it, I can feel it in my capillaries. We out here and we showing no fear. Revolution's coming near, you don't want us as an adversary.
Fight the power!
Fight the power!
Riches on the earth got so many needs. I'm a giant, so they looking like my mini-me's. Never been a killer, but the world is tempting me. Steady killing me, but would never put an end to me. Fight the power, so in public, I'm the enemy. Privately contending with intentions of my energy. System all cap, feel like Kaepernick when he in the league. Overcoming haters like John Taylor, we in the lead. I deserve this gold medal. It's from the soil where we once settled. They want to spoil everyone's ghetto. My future son is about to know the level of expectation to be a black man in this generation. Cause this time, the revolution will be televised. Bringing the evolution of mankind. When you hear me speak, you can tell I'm wise. Truth set us free, that's why they tell us lies. Questioning everything I recognize.
Fight the power!
Fight the power!
This is how the revolution sound. And you know we say fight the power!
Fight the power!
This is how the revolution sound. And you know we say,
you can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation.
Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yeah, it's coming, coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yeah, it's coming, coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yeah, it's coming, coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yeah, it's coming, coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yeah, it's coming, coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yeah, it's coming, coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yes, it's coming. Revolution's coming, yeah, it's coming, coming.
Views from the ground.
Views from the damn ground.
Views from the ground.
Views from the damn ground.
Views from the ground.
Views from the damn ground.
And that's on that, on that, on that. Everyone, this is DJ Love, everyone's favorite agender host. And we are live here on KFAI and WFMU Frogtown Radio. This and we are celebrating our 4-year anniversary all month here. So views from the ground, views from the damn ground has made it all 4 years here. And this is also my 14th year at KFAI being here on the radio. So, and I just thought what would be the most fun thing to do during my 4-year anniversary, then invite my friend on to talk. I know some people know this, some people don't, but I love to play chess. I have like 3 chess tattoos, and I run a chess club, and I also have my friend here who also loves chess, G10 Patel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, DJ. Thank you for having me.
Yes, and G10 is the highest, has the highest attainable tournament director in the country. So, so we're just, as a national tournament director, so I'm just honored that you're on the show today.
Not the only national tournament
you're
director.
You're not the only, but
it's like a black belt, yes.
Yes.
There are a lot of black belts.
They are a lot of black belts. So, tell us what got you into chess.
So when I was in elementary, or I was a kid, my parents owned this convenience store, and there was a customer that always came in and would say, "You're smart, when are you going to join chess club?" And he would say it a lot and a lot, all the time. His 2 kids played chess, they were very good, but At some point, I finally said, okay, yeah, I looked it up in a article. Like, oh, I know what chess is now. Good. And then ended up joining chess club in fourth grade. That's how I got my start.
Yeah, and tell us about your chess career, you know, as like, you know, a young person and how that transition happened going into being an adult.
It was probably one of the few things I really stuck with. I did violin for maybe half a year for first few months in fourth grade. I did football for one day, and
that's so real.
I did basketball in seventh grade for the season, but not further. And chess kind of just stuck. It was very something I enjoyed doing for sure. So,
and what do you think it is about chess that really stuck with you?
It humbles you very much so. It's odd to be playing an adult at a young age or to have that happen. It's like you take any other sport like basketball or football or whatever, you can be the best 9-year-old in the world and you probably still won't even make a JV high school team. Chess is different. It lends itself to prodigies, and it's something where you can be on par with. I mean, obviously, if you can beat your mom and dad, okay, you're better than your parents, or you can beat an adult. But I mean, you can at a young age. It's crazy how you can basically walk, you know, be against another person twice your size, twice your age, and you can call yourselves equals at the end of the day. Chess is something that it's kind of a universal language. I mean, you can be halfway across the world, not know a lick of whatever language you're on, and if you didn't have your smartphone on you, and you could sit down with the chessboard and somebody could come up and play a game with you, and you've never met that person, you don't know what language they speak, and you can speak that language for that duration of time.
Yeah. I love that, focusing definitely on the youth there. And yeah, just the universal part of it, right? It's his own language. They used to say it was an art and a science at the same time, back in the day. So you know, me and you have both been chess coaches for a while now. We don't have to put numbers on it. And so we know that sometimes that people, like, they'll do chess a lot when they're younger, and then once they graduate high school, they're kind of like, all right, I did it in high, you know. I've seen people get up to, like, chess master or international master, then once they graduate, they are done with chess. What kept you coming back for more, even as an adult?
I mean, master, that sounds like a lofty title. I'm not even close to there yet. I'm not even wouldn't even call myself a phenomenal player by any means. But it was just something that, especially in middle school, it was there for me when other things in life were not. And in some way, this is a way for me to share that and give back on some level, at least with the coaching I do or other ways I am involved other than just playing. I can't say I play much anymore unless it's on my phone and I have a beverage in my hand of some sort. I do direct more, obviously, but there was a transition where I was like, I could see myself playing for life or whatever. I mean, it didn't hurt that I stayed here in Minneapolis or in Minnesota. Went to Sonneson Elementary. That's where I first learned chess under the great Larry Lampert, who also founded the School Chess Association. Now passed, but Lorraine is doing a wonderful job running that in his stead, in his step. And So that's where my first childhood chess began. And then throughout the Robbinsdale District 281 and then college at the U of M. So it was easy to keep chess going. So got into coaching in high school. Actually, it was supposed to be for a social studies class where it's like, okay, you get that easy A where you have to do like 10 hours of volunteer community service, but it was mandatory, so it's an oxymoron if you think about it. But so I did it. I did my 10 hours, but I liked it so much I did for the whole year. So at the end of the school, or at the end of the chess season, they're like, well, how do you like to do it more? So that's how I got into coaching, actually.
Yeah, and so with that question, that leads me to, how do we know each other, G-Dub?
Is that a trick question or something?
No.
I want to say it's Redeemer. Is that where we met?
I think it might have been, but, you know, I actually don't know, because sometimes I'm like, I met this person 15 years ago, and they're like, I knew you when you were two, because my dad is a chess master, and whenever he used to go to tournaments in the 90s, he would take me there, and I met people, and apparently don't remember them, because I was three. But yeah, I'm pretty sure we met at, like, Redeemer. That sounds right.
Yeah, there's an individual by the name of Jack Mangan, and he did a lot of wonderful work in the Minneapolis schools. So during college, one of my coaching gigs was at Marcy Holmes and Lake Harriet. So those are two districts two schools in the Minneapolis district, and I was working with those, and they had this tournament called the Check It Out Tournament. It's still ongoing, and now I'm a part of it. Started at those tournaments, and again, there's a Jack Mangan who ran it, and then he took me to other clubs and other chess meets, and one of them was Redeemer Church, and he's like, I want you to meet somebody, and his name was DJ. So,
yeah, and I remember we played many games in the basement.
I lost many games in the basement.
We both lost many games. So, and so that's been cool. And then, like, yeah, also the part of, like, Check It Out as well. We've had several Check It Out champions that have come onto the show and talk. So, yeah, tell us, because Check It Out really started in the 90s. And then the late 90s, and then really continued onwards. About what point did you get involved with the Check It Out tournaments?
So I want to say probably mid-2000s, like 2005 in that area when I started college. So I graduated in 03, started doing Lake Harriet in 04, 05, and for several years then. But that's when I was introduced to the Check It Out tournaments. And at Lake Harriet, they were, I guess, the cream of the crop there. They weren't really, the Check It Out tournament I was told it was designed for people that are first starting out or getting their feet wet in chess. And at the time, Lake Harriet was competing for state titles, not city titles at Minneapolis. So, the idea, the philosophy was, well, we're going to volunteer at this event instead of play it and dominate ourselves, or not me, but our kids. So that was a nice thing. So a lot of Lake Harriet kids were volunteers along with myself and helping adjudicate the game or tournament direct the game. So that's how I started with Check It Out. And then I graduated and got out of college and still looking for a job. And so there was a lapse of time, and then definitely got back into it with other events that happened. I think I want to say about 10 years ago is when I kind of came back a little bit into it, into the Check It Out tournaments, and just playing the role, a similar role where I did before. This thing called COVID happened.
I haven't heard of it.
No. You should look it up. It's a thing. So after that, there was a hard reset, basically, and things change, and there were other people. I mean, you and I were still there, but we'll say there's a, due to other life events that happened and other events that happened, the roles changed, you know, where I was the main floor director and you were an assistant, so that for the most part, but then we kind of flipped roles around where I was the main organizer or started organizing those tournaments, and then you became the floor, head floor judge.
Yeah.
And doing great, I must say. So
appreciate you.
You do there's something that you do that I can't do, which is excite the people in that way, where I'll be more reserved, as you know. But ever since COVID, it's kind of ramped up like a whole lot.
Yeah, yeah, because we used to, I remember, because I used to compete in these tournaments, Check It Out, and I remember it would be like, you know, 50, 60 people, youth, like,
yeah,
over the course.
It was at North High School.
North High School.
And maybe 100 people total.
That part.
The thing I remember the most was the orange Gatorade or orange orange drink that came afterwards during lunch. I was like, yes, I was looking forward to that orange drink. And that was the thing. There's maybe 100 people total playing. And now we have like 100 people playing in one of the divisions alone. And that's cool.
Yeah, because during COVID, we had the Queen's Gambit. And then we had Nakamaru become the number one chess streamer for a little bit. And then we just see this explosion of like 270 youth show up at one of the first Check It Out after, you know, things started opening up after COVID. And so it was just crazy. And it's really maintained that energy. We added a third tournament as well.
Yep.
And now we're looking to do a tournament of champions this Saturday. So
it is. It's coming up.
Yeah. So.
Well, even this year more specifically, shout out to Armitage.
Oh, yes.
They're the K3 state champions. And that was nice to see where, you know, you just build that. You've heard me say this a lot, but it's chess, community, and culture. And a matter of just building up that community, building up that culture, and then some of them decided to take the leap and go, let's play in the state tournament. And then winning the state title, that was a delight to see. And hope it continues to for more Minneapolis schools to get that kind of recognition, too.
Yeah, that's just so cool that this thing that, you know, we volunteer to keep it going, and just seeing that it actually just like takes off and people are you know, actually winning state titles. And I think the most important thing is youth are having fun, right? That's the one I always love to stress, is that the youth are having fun and they can say, I went here, we played chess for most of the day, and it was so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I do get gigs all over. I mean, I'll be in Vegas in a couple of weeks. I'll be in Chicago not too long after. You know, working those national tournaments, you get to know a lot of people. But even that, I have to say some of the most fun tournaments I do are the Check It Outs. And it's nice. It's like it's probably the largest volunteer led tournament in the state, and we run three of them, and those are probably the most fun tournaments I do, aside from all the ones I get opportunities to do.
Yes, and yes, we just very much appreciate you as well putting in the work and helping, because you are so busy, you know, in between going in and out of town for different national tournaments, so, and helping run those, and then just to be able to come home and help us, we just very much appreciate it. And let's move on to some of the tournament directing that you do. Tell us how you talked a lot about how you got into chess and then going to the U. When did you really start directing tournaments?
I don't know. It almost felt like a natural progression. I mean, first I was coaching for a while, then, but I was involved with a lot of the tournaments. And then the state association, I mean, I would obviously support those tournaments too. And, you know, they're putting on their state scholastics. But after a couple years, the president at the time basically asked, hey, do you want to be the scholastic coordinator for the association? And I was like, what do I do? It's like, you didn't know either. He's like, make it up. Just run with it. So I did. And so I started acting as a advocate that way. And again, for the same thing that I would mention before, like kids can beat adults. It's crazy. Don't believe, you know, whether you believe it or not, kids can beat adults. And, or just giving that experience to, you know, being in that, it kind of like, it grows you up. It matures you quick when you're sitting in a tournament. I mean, yeah, you can do all the scholastic tournaments you want, but when you're playing in like a state tournament and you're, again, you're against a behemoth of a man that's towering over you, and yeah, it grows you up quick. So after some time as a scholastic coordinator, I served on the board as well, for the board of directors.
We did it together.
There was that one year, yes.
Yeah, the one year we did it together. It was too much for me. We'll continue.
But then also, like, yeah, I think it would have been like 2015 or so, is when, we'll say, succession plan of sorts, where the main director at the time was probably still is, but 40 years older than me. And yes, he still is 40 years older than me. That's how math works. But so there was this big gap of who's running tournaments. And I was like, well, okay. I felt familiar with the software and all the rules and all that. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll start running, or I'll start helping direct tournaments. So I was kind of under his wing. His name is David Koons, a very well-known figure in Minnesota chess. And you know, I credit him for bringing me under his wing and learning a lot under him. And from there, an organizer from Chicago came to hold a national event there and got to know him. His name is Glenn Banner. And
yep.
He was the one that got me involved into the national circuit or scene of things, where getting those invites on a lot of tournaments there. So those are two people I would definitely credit immensely. And so I started directing more and more, and then just got into it that way. I guess I do enjoy that part of it. And what that meant was I also had to play less. So instead of playing in tournaments, now I have to direct a tournament. So that transition was not, I wouldn't say it was the easiest one, but but then I just like that part of it a lot more, that being able to make those decisions or basically advocating chess that way. So
yeah, and yeah, shout out to David Koons, who was a big person in Minnesota chess and also in the national chess scene, helping write some of the national stuff with the rulings and stuff. So
yeah, he was on the rules committee, so yeah. He knew that, he knew him in and out. So
yeah, so tell us, like, how do you obtain different titles, because there's a several different, like, senior TD and all that stuff before you reach the national tournament director. How do you go up those?
I mean, the short answer is you play, or you direct in a lot of events, and you serve under you serve as a tournament director under somebody higher. back to Dave. He gave me a lot of tips and guidance, and a lot of it is just, if you want to do it, then you do it. Like, if you want to learn more, then you can. I mean, there are going to be, again, with all that I've seen with, as far as, you know, tournament directors from all sorts, there are people that kind of just mail it in, so to speak, but then there are ones that want to be more of an active role or active member in this. And it's, I mean, there's the rule book, right? You have to know the rules, or you at least be familiar with them, or be able to rule on them, or adjudicate them, or interpret the rules, just like as a Supreme Court interprets the rules of the Constitution, whatever. So, you know, my job is to interpret the rules and give rulings based on situations that happen. But that's just the book. The book does not tell you how to behave. It does not tell you anything about what to do when someone's crying or whatever. It doesn't tell you any of that. It's, being a tournament director is largely an exercise in customer service, and you have to treat everyone well. You have to treat people as you, in a way that you want to be treated, but also just being able to come to quick decisions when you need to, or if something happens, being able to improvise when things go down or whatever. Just having that all built up. I mean, let me tell you, I make a lot of mistakes during a tournament, and it's not so much that other directors make similar mistakes. It's the kind of like the ability to react to them and then rise up to them, or be able to find a way, you know, to navigate those waters. But yeah, it's literally customer service, because if you don't provide a good experience, then people are probably not going to come. You're going to get the people that are the diehards, like the people that you're going to hit in the hammer over and over again, but they'll still show up because they're just very, it's chess, they'll show up. And then you get the regulars, and those are the people that are going to show up at a lot of the big events, right? And you can always rely on those two groups of populations. But then there's this third group, the fringe population, the ones that are just trying it out for the first time. And that can make it break if they have a good experience, if they keep doing it. The question is, how do you capture that fringe group where you can rely on the other two groups, but I'm going to butcher this quote from the Germans, but it's something about building a, like, don't chase butterflies, build a good garden, let the butterflies come to you. And if I had it with me, I'd say it more eloquently than that, but yeah. My goal is to build a garden and build a good one. And if people come, people come, but that's my goal there.
Yeah, and you were amazing at that, and I just want to say that you always make people feel welcome and excited, and you remember people, and I just think you do just such a great job. And the Minnesota chess has, it's a very strong scene. It's very close and connected, and I think in recent times, one of the things, the lifeblood of the scene, is you, G10, and I just, like, really appreciate you and what you do for the chess scene, so.
That's, thank you. That's very nice of you to say.
And so, last question. So we've talked about how you're a national tournament director, and you do these large tournaments, and they fly you out, and you get to do the tournaments and stuff. Tell us, you know, let us know what some of the tournaments are, you know, that you've helped with.
Oh, the tournaments went great. There's no controversy, no drama, no, no, they're like squeaky clean tournaments. What are you talking about, DJ?
Yeah. But like, tell us which tournaments, name some of the tournaments that you've like helped with recently and are be helping with. You kind of preluded to it since you were talking about Chicago and stuff like that. But what were the name of the tournaments?
Not most recently, but I guess within the last couple months, there was the National High School Championships in Chicago. There was a National Amateur, they call it the National Amateur North Individual, that happened in Milwaukee. There's a team, Amateur Team North, that happened in February. There's our own state Scholastic there. I wasn't a director for that one, but I was there and serving as a resource. Let's not forget our Check It Out champions this Saturday, that we can't ignore all, you know, there's all these accolades, but you can't ignore the ones that got you going in the first place. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the Check It Out champions. This upcoming weekend, next weekend, will be the Minneapolis Open. That's at the Chess Castle. You're still able to sign up for that for anyone that has that inkling to do so. So then that's the 5th through the 7th. So and then right after that, I'll be headed to the National Open at the Westgate in Vegas. And then I'll have some time to relax. And then 2 days later, I'll head out to Chicago for the National Junior and Senior Open. And there's also the National Blind Championships are also taking place there.
Nice. And so it's been such a pleasure being able to talk to you about your journey in chess and for you to share some of your wisdom. I think it really goes back to you know, talking about the youth and your commitment to helping the youth get better at chess and also get these skills that are, you know, even if that doesn't make them a chess master, it helps them with critical thinking, it helps them with self-confidence and, you know, all those things that you were talking about that help you be a good tournament director. Like, the rules doesn't tell you what to do when the youth starts crying, right?
Right.
And so just doing all of those great things, we just really appreciate you, so.
Thank you. No, it's, you don't have to be a strong player to be a strong director. I'm proof of that. But even just starting chess, I mean, even if you just have it as a skill lifelong, that you could always pick it up. Let's say, again, back to like basketball, those are limitations. So let's say you're 80 years old and your son or daughter, you know, considerably younger, you know, they're in their 50s or whatever, but there'll be a point in time where you can't throw a ball or shoot hoops with your kids anymore. But you can certainly sit down and play a game of chess. So you can still do that. And that's kind of nice where you lose some of that other activity. So.
Yes. Which is funny you set that example because my dad is definitely 70 years old and he still beats me at games of chess. So I was like, oh my God, why is he playing such complicated chess? I thought, you know, but yeah, it just stays there with you, a part of it. So, yeah, so just appreciate you so much, Gita.
I appreciate you too, DJ.
With that, we're going to listen to some Nat King Cole, Nature Boy.
There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far, very far, over land and sea. A little shy and sad of eye, but very wise was he.
And then one day, a magic day, he passed my way. And while we spoke of many things, fools and kings, this he said to me. The greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return. The greatest thing you'll ever learn is just to love and be loved in return.
Sponsoring KFAR is the Historic Auditorium. This historic venue will be showcasing Horseshoes and Hand Grenades on May 29th, while songwriters Sarah Morris and Kelly Smith showcase their talents on May 30th. Did you know that the Historic Auditorium was established in 1916 and then added to the Wisconsin and National Registers of Historic Places in 2006 and 2007? You can experience live music from a historic venue in St. Croix, Wisconsin. Tickets and more information can be found at thehistoricauditorium.com.
Welcome back to Views from the Ground, Views from the Damn Ground. We are here live with DJ Love here on KFAI and WFMU Frogtown Radio. And we are celebrating our four-year anniversary of the show. And we are here with Justice.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you are a local, like, DJ, artist, you know, working with the youth. You're just all around a good dude.
Trying.
And so it's just nice to have you on the show, and we'll get a little bit into your art. But, you know, tell us about a little bit about your upbringing.
Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for having me, DJ. I grew up in like central rural Nebraska in a town called Aurora. My tribe, I'm enrolled Rosebud Lakota. That reservation's over in South Dakota. But then, yeah, I've been living here, I think, the last 11 years. It'll be 11 years in July. But yeah, grew up in rural Nebraska. Mostly today we'll be talking about kind of the music thing that I do. But yeah, very much came from... Neither of my parents were musicians, but both loved music, and so there was always music playing in the house, in the car, all around. And then, yeah, in my teens, started developing my own musical identity, and then, yeah, kind of launched from there.
Yeah, and what really got you into music when you were younger? What type of music were you listening to and stuff like that?
Yeah, my dad was a rocker. Like, he was really into, yeah, he was born in 63, so, like, that... you know, golden age of, like, classic rock. Kiss was his favorite band, Thin Lizzy, Black Sabbath, Boston, all that stuff. So he was playing that, and then, you know, he liked a lot of 80s and then into the 90s, so, like, 80s pop music and then 90s, like, alternative. All that stuff was around, and then if I was in the car with my mom instead, we'd be listening to, like, yeah, late 80s, early 90s, mid-90s, like, pop country. And I did not like that stuff when I was younger. I love it now. But yeah, so it was just in the house constantly and in the car. Like, I'm very grateful my folks were just really into music. And then when I started getting into, like, skateboarding and certain things when I was in my early teens, that's when I started to listen to things that more underground branched out, and like punk music and anything else that maybe my parents weren't listening to. And so, yeah, I think I was just very fortunate that my folks were both into music in their own way, and then they were pretty music felt accessible to me as time went on, even though I was listening to pretty inaccessible music in certain ways based off where I was. So,
yeah, and where do you go from? How do you get to Minneapolis?
That's a trajectory. Yeah, I don't know. I lived in Olympia, Washington, right out of high school, and then I moved to Omaha, Nebraska from there, which is the city in Nebraska. And then after that, I ended up in Providence, Rhode Island. And then after that, I ended up here because I knew folks through playing punk music, and I knew there were a bunch of natives here. And I was like, well, if I'm going to go back to the Midwest, I want to be in a place where there's community for everything that I'm involved with or wanting to be involved with or anything I can be a part of. So, yeah, ended up here, yeah, because I knew there were Indians here and I knew there was music. So,
yeah, and so you do a lot of... you have a lot of records.
Yeah.
And you do a lot of DJing and bring your own record. And tell us a little bit of how you got into that.
Yeah. I mean, it's now I primarily DJ all, like, native rock and roll, folk, and country music. And when I say that, like, American Indian, First Nations bands and artists that were their records maybe never left their reservation or communities. And so I try and find those records and 8-tracks, cassette tapes, and I digitize them and do a lot of work with them, but I also bring them out to events and bring turntables and spin. So before that, I was DJing just all sorts of stuff, mostly like, yeah, country and rock and roll, punk, metal music, whatever it may have been. And then at a certain point, through my work in the Native community, folks were like, oh, that guy spins records. And they're like, oh, he spins Native records. And I never actually done that exclusively before, and I think someone just thought that that's what I did, and then I started to get asked to do it, and I was like, oh, I guess this is a thing. And so I went from just being like a vinyl DJ to a Native performer, more or less. And so then I'd get hired for different gigs, and you know, I have a radio show, and I do a lot of like archival work and preservation work with this stuff. But initially, it just kind of happened. Like, someone was like, ah, oh, that guy with that, you know, there's only like one Justice Broken Rope in the world. So they were like, you know, that Justice Broken Rope guy plays Indian records. Like, let's bring him out, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your radio program.
I have a show called Watetra Radio, which is part of the project I do. Watetra Records is, I guess, archival project around the preservation of Native music, Native rock and roll, country, contemporary music. And the radio show is kind of the offshoot of that. It streams on NTS, which is a streaming platform based out of London and L.A., and I'm in my second residency with them. So right now I have it where I'm doing one show every other month, but the whole show is all, yeah, American Indian music, and then I only speak my tribe's language when I speak in it. So I speak a dialect of it called Dakota, which is the language of the land we're on right now, Minnesota. And so I only speak in Dakota in it because I want there to be more language resources for my tribe as well. So
yeah, and it's just amazing work twofold. It's like the archival work of the music and then also like the language preservation. It's just like amazing, and I'm also a fan of the show. So
hell yeah, thank you.
So I just appreciate you for doing it, and I just, you know, as a DJ, I've been on for like, you know, perform, you know, I DJ for the last 14 years here on KFAI. And my dream is to find, like, you know, a song that's un-Shazamable. You know what I mean? Like, Shazam's like, it doesn't exist. I'm like, it's right here. Like, that's my dream. You have entire sets that are completely un-Shazamable. Like, it's crazy. It's actually crazy. Like, I'm just like, I'm on the No, I'm not. I was like, why did I even try? Like, and so just that, like, history component to it as well, because, you know, everyone thinks that everything is on the internet.
Yeah.
And it's not. And especially when we start talking about music, a lot of it's not on the internet. And a lot of people don't realize that. And so we're missing a lot of those voices and those stories. Because when we talk about the voices that are missing, it really is the folks of color. And so, yeah, I just appreciate what you do. And
no, thank you. I mean, that's it right there. It's like, as a Native person, I wanted to hear these artists and these Native musicians. And growing up, like, where I was, and even as an adult, I wasn't hearing that. And so that was the thing where it's like, what I did became, or it came with something because I wanted to see it happen. And it was very much rooted in, like, a DIY ethic of where I come from in my music community's background. And, yeah, it was just, it is funny because a lot of folks are like, yeah, I tried looking this up on Shazam or Spotify and I couldn't find it. I was like, I know, that's the problem. Like, or rather, that's like the thing we're trying to solve here. And, you know, I put everything on YouTube that I digitize, and it's just ongoing, and I try and do as much as I can with it. It's very much like a side project kind of thing, but that's the thrill of it too. And, you know, like you're saying, DJing, like, that's always, you know, you want to play stuff that maybe folks haven't heard before, get folks excited. And then you also got to play like the hits and classics too, because you need people to want to stick around and, you know, play something with a hook that they already know. So I always do play like Redbone or like Link Ray, you know, classics, but then throwing in there a bunch of stuff, it's like, hey, there's this band from your reservation you may have never heard before, but check this song out. And then maybe your uncle was in that band too, or your grandpa was in that band, or your grandma sang on this song, like something like that. So the community aspect of it and the preservation and then the accessibility of wanting to get this music out there and have people engage with it in that way is pretty much why I do it. And it was just kind of this thing that happened organically that I didn't really intend on, and it just kind of kept developing as time went on. So
how many records do you think you have?
I don't know. I think, yeah, it's like, I haven't counted, and of the Native records, probably like 300 or so at this point. And that would be like records, vinyl as in like, you know, 12-inch LPs, 45s, and then 8-tracks and cassette tapes too, because I digitize all that stuff as well. And then, I don't know, I mean, overall, like, if I were to do everything in my collection, probably nearing a couple thousand. But I also just try and get rid of stuff constantly too. I think I sell probably as much as I buy, and I'm just, you know, trying to rotate things out, because at the end of the day, it's a bunch of stuff, and also I'm tired of moving around with, you know, several hundred to a couple thousand records. They're not light materials.
Correct. So you said you sell some of them. Do you also sell the Native ones?
I do, yeah. If there's so many records that were recorded, and sometimes without consent of, you know, ceremonial songs, traditional songs, powwow songs, things like that, that if they're not from my tribe, like Lakota or Dakota, I don't necessarily feel like I should be the one keeping them. And a lot of these ones, I go out, historically they were purchased or like often sometimes gatekept by like white record collectors. And so for me, I'm like, I just want to get this stuff back out to Native people. And so when I do sell records that fall out of like the theme that I do, which is like Native rock and country music, you know, I try and just sell them for a few bucks to break even and below market, with the intention and idea that, like the person, and I have like a disclaimer where I'm like, I only really want you purchasing this if you're a Native person, just because I think that so much of our art and so much of our contributions have been obviously taken from us over the years, and it's been a challenge to get a lot of that back. And so for me, if the music is a little crumb of that larger picture that I can kind of bring back forward or, you know, put back out there, then I try and do it. So yeah, like a lot of, I worked like a market in Tulsa like a month or so ago and just was able to get a lot of those records out there in person, which was great. And then I throw them online on a web store too. So, yeah.
So you also have a new book out as well. Yeah. So, and the book is also connected to this project, right? So go ahead and tell us a little bit about the book, what's his name, what it's doing.
Yeah, so the book came out about in January or so, and it's called Wetetra Records Sourcebook. There's another artist in town, Ryan Nelson, And he got a grant, wanted to do a couple books, and he reached out to me because he had heard my radio show. And we'd never met before and had him over and, yeah, just, I don't know, chatted about it. And I thought, you know, this guy seems like he knows what he's doing and he wants to do it in a good way and he wants to be respectful with the materials. So for me, it was like, and he showed me how he wanted to do it, and I liked it, and I thought he had really good taste, and I think we just saw eye to eye on the project. And so it took a, you know, year and a half, couple years, and I provided all the content in it, but he did all the layout, the design work, the publishing. It's very much his project as well. And so, yeah, I'm really proud of it. I view it as kind of the visual companion to the music. So when you're listening to my radio show or when you listen to the records on YouTube or wherever you might hear it, this is kind of the side of where you might see that native representation more. You might have a better idea of what the communities these artists were coming from at the time they were recording these songs or writing these albums, and just having a better idea of the artists in general.
Yeah, and so it's like an art book, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so what inspired you to go that direction with the book?
You know, I'm a music guy, and like I think most of my everything I do in so many ways is oriented around sound and language and a lot of different things. But you know, we're also visual too in terms of like native art and a lot of different aspects of native culture. And so I thought, you know, like if someone wants to help me or put in this work to make this happen. You know, it's funny to look at read a book about music. Like, I kind of talk about that in the preface where I'm like, you're holding this, but you may not know what any of it sounds like. But to see it still is just as important, especially as Native people, to have that representation. You know, to see a Native person holding a guitar, to see someone who looks like you holding a guitar, playing drums, or, you know, wearing the same kind of denim jacket, that stuff is important too, you know? And so for me, the book was that kind of partnership with the music or the companion in itself where, hey, like, yeah, this stuff sounds good, but it looks good too, you know?
Yeah, and we have a lot of pictures of Native artists and also of album art. And so with some of the albums that you took pictures of and put in the book is about 28 pages. And you said you had about 300 records. How did you choose which records got put in the book?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was really just, I don't know. There were ones that I said to Ryan, I was like, I want this in here. I was like, this is my favorite album cover out of like this whole thing. Like, please put this in here. Or like, maybe you want this. This is from a geography or region where there's not a lot of like artists or bands. And so it was very much, yeah, like I pulled a stack and then we narrowed it down from there. And, you know, he took all the pictures, he did all the scans. There's obviously like different ephemera and like notes and little things that you might find around my desk of stuff that I'm working on when I'm recording a radio show or digitizing something. So it's kind of just like the inside, you know, or behind the scenes kind of view of like what this project looks like for me, and then also what record covers that I really enjoy looking at or that I think are significant to the overall like history of these movements and kind of this history that's been swept under the rug historically.
So who are some of your favorite Native artists?
Yeah, there is one that you can't actually stream this on streaming services, but this band Sugluk, they're an Inuit rock band, and I joke that they're like the reservation CCR. Like, they sound like Creedence, sort of. It's that vibe. And a lot of Natives love Creedence for a lot of different reasons, but they were up in a remote region, and, you know, there's, I think, like six guys in the band, maybe, and had electric guitars, drums, and they wrote these original songs. They didn't record any covers, and they have 245s that the CBC, Canadian Broadcast Company, put out, and half the music is in their language, Inuktitut. And so to hear music that was contemporary at the time but then also is in their tribal language, to me is so powerful and important. And, you know, at a time when all these were, most of these artists were of the boarding school generation. So they were actively, you know, dealing with, you know, genocide and assimilation practices, and really a generation that was taught to fear speaking your language or being culturally intact, who you are spiritually, language, whatever it might be. So for them to still do that is an act of resilience on its own. And they're not the only band that did that, but they're probably my favorite band, like, sonically out of that whole.
And how would you spell that?
S-U-G-L-U-K.
And do you have, like, a favorite native solo artist that isn't in a band?
Yeah, native solo artists. I think off the top of my head, I mean, probably Link Wray. And he, yeah, I mean, he's pretty famous. He wrote Rumble, which is, you know, considered the first time the power chord was heard as in a rock song. And it's an instrumental. But, yeah, I think for him, it's just one of those things where he wasn't really acknowledged as being native for a long time. And then later on, people started talking about it. And, you know, you hear his songs in car commercials and, like, arenas and stadiums, things like that. But, you know, him as a solo artist, just he cranked out so much good music as well, beyond just, like, a few of the hits that he had.
And we are running out of time here, so my last question is going to be, where do you find a lot of your music?
Oh, man. It used to be back in the day when I would go on tour. I would just go to record stores. I had stores in every city that I knew to look out for and that I liked digging at. And so digging, historically, thrift stores, record stores, casting a net on eBay, save searches, things like that, trying to track things down, research, like figuring out what I should be looking for when I'm able to. Discogs, obviously, is like the main place where records are sold these days. And then often people tell me about stuff. Sometimes people will gift me things. They'll be like, hey, I found this, or this was my auntie's like project that she had in the 80s or the 70s. Like, maybe you want to hear it or do something with it. So really, yeah, in a lot of ways, it's a collaborative effort and a community thing. And people, now that they know me through the project, are like, hey, I found this. Do you know of it? And so people help me out, too. It is like it's a thing where everyone kind of contributes in some way.
Yeah, and if there was, like, a white person or a non-native who had some native music and they wanted to give it to an indigenous person, what would be the best way you feel like they would be able to do that?
I mean, for me, I've had that happen a lot, where people will message me on Instagram or email me, and they'll be like, I have, like, record store owners, for instance. I have friends in New York who own a couple the best shops in New York, in my opinion, and they have so much turnover, they're buying so much, and then they'll have a stack of, you know, 60, 70 records or something. They're like, we know what you do with this stuff. We'd rather you get it out there than us try and sell it to a bunch of usually non-native people. So
yes, and can you share what your Instagram and stuff, ways of being able to contact you is?
Yeah, so Instagram and YouTube, where you can hear all the records, would be Wateca, Watheca. .records, and that's also my email as well. So the Instagram, Wateca.records, or at Wateca Records, and then the YouTube, same thing. Those would be the best ways to get a hold of me, and there's an email address linked in there as well. So,
all right. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. Today was a great day. I really appreciate you and G-Ton. This is a great way to end our four-year anniversary here of the month. And, yeah, we look forward to you coming back to the show, hopefully to spin some vinyls.
Anytime. Appreciate you bringing me up.
Yes. With that being said, I just want to – this is everyone's favorite Agender host, DJ Love, reminding you that the binary is always an illusion.
We'll not answer phone when you go. And here comes the policeman. He say that he protect and serve, but that same policeman beat you down face to face.